Bibles to Revelation chapter 13. We are going to start there in just a moment. I appreciate everyone's presence today. I love you all. I'm glad we can open up the book of Revelation together yet again. We've been walking through the book of Revelation ever so often throughout this year. And we are on the second half of the book of Revelation. The first part of Revelation, chapters 1 all the way to chapter 11, talked about this great judgment that God is going to pour out upon his enemies. But it doesn't give us all the specifics that we might like to have. And chapters 12 and onward are going to really kind of tell the same story of God's judgment upon his enemies, but it's going to do it with a lot more specifics and a lot more details about who these enemies are and what the children of God needed to stay away from there in the first and second century. We're going to be in chapter 13, and to start this out, just remember, we talked about chapter 12 about a month ago. We talked about chapter 12. Chapter 12 began this idea that there in Revelation 12, there was this woman who gives birth to a son. We identified this son as being Jesus Christ himself. He is born, but then he ascends into heaven. And now that this dragon, who is Satan, cannot destroy the son, he looks to destroy the woman who gave birth to her. But then what happens to this woman? Well, the woman gets away as well. God protects this woman. And so he is further enraged in chapter 12 because he cannot destroy the woman. And so what does he do? He goes to destroy the rest of her offspring, talking about the rest of the children of God there in among the church. And so he's talking in Revelation chapter 12, and in verse 17, this sets us up for the rest of chapter 13. Verse 17 says, "So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus." It's pretty easy to identify. Who's this talking about? Well, it's talking about Christians. It's talking about the church. And so the dragon is enraged. Satan is enraged. And he wants to persecute and destroy the church there in the first and second century. How is he going to do it? Well, that's chapter 13. In chapter 13, what we're going to see are two beasts. He says, verse 1, it says, "The dragon stood up on the sand of the seashore, and then I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on its horns there were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names." That's one beast, and we're going to identify this as the sea beast because he comes out of the sea in verse 1. Later on, in verse 11, we have another beast. He says, "Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth," and we're going to identify that as the earth beast because he comes out of the earth. So this chapter can be divided up very neatly into two parts. 1 through 10 talk about the sea beast. Verses 11 through 18 talk about this earth beast. And we're going to see a lot of details here, but details are going to be very familiar to us. They should be familiar to us because we did a little bit of background study about some of these ideas. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we took the opportunity to look at Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 as kind of a backdrop to some of these ideas. If you remember, in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, you have two chapters that really are really the same idea. In Daniel chapter 2, you have a dream of Nebuchadnezzar as he dreams about four kingdoms, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. He dreams about these kingdoms, and he doesn't know what's going on, and so Daniel comes and he interprets for Nebuchadnezzar, and he gives him this idea that, well, one day in this fourth kingdom, God on high, the Almighty, is going to set up his own kingdom. And so while these kingdoms are important, the most important thing is about this kingdom that God would set up. And it's this wonderful thing. God is using Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 then to tell the people of Israel who are in captivity, God's not done with you yet. They're joyful chapters. God's not done with you yet. God has plans for his people, and he is going to establish his kingdom. Even though right now it looks like, how are the people of Israel? They're stuck.
They're in captivity. They're slaves. They're prisoners. God's going to change all of that. And one day he's going to establish his own kingdom. Just wait for it. So Daniel chapter 2 sets us up for that. But Daniel chapter 7 does the same thing. And so we have a lion, we have a bear, we have a leopard, and then we have a fourth beast that Daniel doesn't even know what to call it. It's just a strange beast. But it does the same job to say, well, these are different kingdoms that are going to come and they're going to overpower the people of God. But during the time of the fourth kingdom, during that time of that fourth kingdom, then God would set up his own kingdom. As you could, how would you imagine being a Christian then during the first century? When finally the Messiah comes, his name is Jesus, and he speaks with you, his apostles speak with you, you understand he is the Messiah, he is the Christ, and that now he's setting up the kingdom and you get to be a part of it. So reading these chapters, how would you feel? Wow, look what God has planned for all of these centuries. We're looking back to 600 BC, 600 years before Jesus, that God is planning out all of these things, and then God would finally establish his kingdom. And guess what? I get to be a part of it. Could you imagine how joyful that ought to be for us as well? That here is this plan that God made back then, but then in the first century, during the times of the New Testament, these are things that God fulfilled. His word is powerful and his word is fulfilled. However, another thing that we saw when we were looking at Daniel chapter 7 is that not all of this chapter is about joy and fulfillment and just good things to come. And in fact, in Daniel chapter 7, there is a lot of detail that is given to persecutions that would occur against the people of God even during this fourth kingdom. So for example, in Daniel chapter 7, you have these sea beasts, these beasts that come out of the sea, and so they're sea beasts. You have these beasts that are like a lion and a bear and a leopard and then a fourth beast. And there's a lot of detail that's given in Daniel chapter 7 to this horn that comes out of the beast. I'm sorry, I'm not a very good artist, but there you go. You got this horn. It has eyes and he has a mouth and he's speaking perverse things. I don't know if you can see the red, but he's speaking perverse things and arrogant things. And he's speaking against God and he's speaking against the saints, and he is waging war against the saints. This is an important idea. Look what he says in chapter 7. I told you to go to Revelation. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 7 for just a brief moment. Daniel chapter 7 and in verse 17, he says there in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 17, these great beasts are four in number. These four kings will rise from the earth, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. This is the idea of Daniel chapter 7. Okay, if we get lost by the details, verses 17 and 18, there's your summary verses that tell us what's going on here. Four kingdoms, but God's kingdom is forever. You can count on what God plans and what he will finish. But then this horn comes along, and Daniel wants to know more information about this horn. And so Daniel chapter 7 continues to talk about this. In verse 19, for example, he says, I desire to know more, the exact meaning of the fourth beast. And also in verse 10, the meaning of the ten horns and the one horn, which had eyes and a mouth and uttered great boasts. And then finally, someone comes and gives him more information. Look at verse 21. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Later on in verse 25, he will speak out, talking about this horn, this king. He will speak out against the Most High. He will wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alterations of the times and the laws. And they will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Put those together, that'd be like three and a half a time and times and then half a time. That's like three and a half. And we'll remember that when we get to the book of Revelation. Because all of these things are going to be significant when we get to Revelation chapter 13. So if you're reading this as a Christian in the first century, what is your mentality? One, you see that in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, you're seeing that God is fulfilling his great promises to you. Wow, that's joyful, isn't it? But there's a little bit of anticipation here as well. Because Daniel chapter 7 is also prophesying that something is going to happen. A persecution is going to happen during this time. This horn is going to come along, and he is going to wage war against us. How are you feeling now about Daniel chapter 7? This is kind of, it's an ominous chapter then. It's not just a joyful chapter, but it also tells you there's something that's very difficult that's going to happen. But despite the difficulties, in these same verses, what is the promise? Verse 22, even though he would wage war against the saints, it says in verse 22, the Ancient of Days would come and judgment would be passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived and the saints took possession of the kingdom. So despite the fact that that this horn would be uttering blasphemous things and they would wage war against the saints, don't worry about it. God is going to win, and he's going to give the kingdom to his saints. Also in verse 25, he says he's going to wear down the little horn. This horn is going to wear down the saints, and he's going to do this for time and times and half a time. But then in verse 26, but the courts will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away and annihilated and destroyed forever. And then the sovereignty and the dominion and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole earth will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. What's the promise? There's going to be persecution during this time. Not just joy, but persecution. But don't worry about it. Stay true to the Lord, and God will win. This is the background to Revelation chapter 13. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13 now. In Revelation chapter 13, we have a section again that's going to talk about a beast. And it's going to be a beast that wages war against the saints. Let's look at these details. Chapter 13 and verse 1, it says, the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and a great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and the fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war with him? There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months. How many years is that? 3.5. It's 3.5 years was given to him. And he opened up his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them in authority. Over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written down in from the foundation of the world and the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. So we have a description of the sea beast. I hope that as we are going through this description, that we notice some connections with Daniel chapter 7. This is not an accident that he's using these descriptions over and over. Daniel chapter 7 set us up to talk about these four different kingdoms and this Roman kingdom, that finally there's going to be a great persecution during this time. And here we have Revelation chapter 13. We have this sea beast that comes out of the sea, has 10 horns. It's like a leopard. It's like a bear. It's like a lion. But then there is one, I got my
asterisks mixed up here a little bit, but there's it also gives the description, one head as if slain but is alive. It's just kind of an interesting thing that you have one of these heads that is, it's been slain but now it's alive. What does it sound like? Sounds like a resurrection of some sort. What we can see here is that there's a lot of things about this beast that call the attention even of the Christians. Just like Jesus was raised from the dead, well, here's a kind of a resurrection. Don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. We'll see this later on in the same chapter. Don't be deceived by this. Stay true to the Lamb. Reject false religions. And that's what this chapter is going to represent. You have this dragon who gives authority to authority, and all worship the dragon and all worship the beast. The mouth of this, you can't see that very well, but the mouth speaks out in arrogance, and he speaks blasphemous words. He acts out for 42 months. That's a year, 3.5 years. And possibly the most clear, he's making war against the saints and he's overcoming them. This is what's going to happen. He writes to the Christians in the book of Revelation, these are the things that will soon take place. Get ready, because the persecution, even though tribulation's already happening, some of the Christians have already died in Revelation chapter 2 and chapter 3. My Antipas, who was killed because of his faith. Here's John, and he's already on the Isle of Patmos because of his faith. Tribulation is already happening for them, but what's going to happen? It's going to get worse. You need to be ready. You need to understand that this is, what's the message? This is the beast that we've been waiting for. You heard about it in Daniel chapter 7, and guess what? He's here. Stay true to God, and you won't have to worry about it. Stay true to God. In fact, at the end of this section, at the end of each description of these beasts, there is a warning to the Christians. This warning in verse 10 starts off with something very similar to what Jesus would say. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity goes. If anyone kills with a sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. I think what he's getting at here is the idea of, you know, what would be the temptation for someone who is being attacked? Well, attack back. What would be the temptation for someone who's being attacked with a sword or attacked with guns or attacked with, you know, whatever, make it his man? Oh, you're not going to treat me that way. But to these Christians, if you live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. The perseverance of the saints is what? Staying true to the Lord. The Lord is going to take care of this beast. You don't have to lift a finger. You need to stay true to the Lord. We'll see this again in verses 11. In verse 11 to the end of the chapter, he's going to talk about another beast. So read with me in verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming up from the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. I don't know how the dragon speaks, but I imagine it doesn't sound like a lamb at all. So you have something that's a lamb. Something that seems like it's so innocent, almost like the Lamb of God. But this is no Lamb of God. This is the dragon, who is Satan. So this is someone who looks like he might offer something that might be true and right. But no. You have to understand that behind all of this costume, there is a dragon. In verse 12, he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast and those who whose fatal wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes the fire come down out of heaven to the earth and into the presence of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which are given to him to perform in the presence of all the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who had a wound of a sword and has come to life. Have you seen what is the job of this second beast? This second beast is not a, what else we can say, he's just a yes man. He is really the PR guy for the first beast. The first beast comes along and he demands everybody to worship him.
But the second beast comes along, and he's the guy that gets everybody, encourages everybody, and does all these different signs in order to get people to believe, yes, worship the first beast. So while we can look at this here, this is a figure that is somehow related to the government. This is going to be a figure that is somehow related to the worship of that government. Some strange ideas here. Later on in the book of Revelation, this second beast is going to be associated with this idea of a false prophet. So we can call him the earth beast, we can call him the second beast, we can call him the false prophet. But he's going to be associated with the worship of the first beast. He's the PR guy. He's the yes man. Yes, worship him. Worship him. And he does all these signs so that people will worship this first beast, especially the fact, wow, he died, but now he is alive again. It says in verse 15 that it was given to him the breath, to give breath to the image of the beast. He's deceiving the world so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the beast or the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free and the slaves, to be given the mark on the right hand and on their forehead. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or of the number of his name. So you have him deceiving the world, pressuring people into worshiping this image, whether you're convinced or not. You better worship this image. And in fact, if you don't worship the image, what happens to you? He kills the people that don't worship the image. And apart from that, he says he gives people who do worship the image a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. Now they are identified. Just as Christians are identified with the seal of God, and we'll see this contrast later on, but just as Christians are identified by the seal of God, now those who are not Christians, those who are not, do not belong to God, they're going to be identified by the beast. Here is this mark that is placed upon them. And if you don't have this mark, then we're not going to allow you to buy, you're not going to be able to sell, so there are economic difficulties that are going to happen here. So what we need to see then is this story that is unfolding. You have the first beast, who is associated somehow with the government. You have a second beast that is pushing the worship, in fact, of this first beast. But here is a warning. Don't do it. Why? Again, each of these beasts finish off with a warning. And in verse 18, we have this warning. In verse 18, he says, here is wisdom. In other words, if you have an ear, let him hear. Listen up. Here's your wisdom. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. This is probably one of the most well-known figures of the Bible. People don't know where exactly to find it sometimes. And most of the time don't know exactly what the context is or what it means. But this is one of the most well-known passages of the Bible. 666. Ah! It gives people terror just thinking about it. In fact, I was reading about one famous person who received, he moved to a certain place and he had the address, 666. And so, he very quickly changes the address. We don't want that number. It's the unlucky number. It has a lot of superstition about it. But definitely here, it's part of the story. 666. But what is this mark of the beast, and what does all of this mean? First of all, just looking at the context itself, and this is I hope that we can appreciate this. Looking at the context itself, looking at the mark of the beast, the context instructs us that this mark of the beast was something that is associated with the Roman government. How can we say that? Well, going back to Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, all of that got us geared up for the fact that when God sets up his kingdom, the kings whatever kings are in power, well, that's when all of this persecution is going to happen as well. So as good students of the Bible, then we ought to be associating this chapter then, something, it has this, whatever the mark of the beast is, the context instructs us that it's associated, one, with the Roman government. Number two, whatever the context, whatever this mark of the beast is, it is also associated with the worship and the allegiance to that government. So it might, although it might be something that's kind of as mysterious for us, what does this all this mean? I think that is instructive for us when we look back at secular history and the persecutions that did indeed go on in the first and second centuries for Christians, to know that emperor worship, worshiping Caesar as a god, was a thing. And in fact, three of the seven churches of Asia had temples devoted to Roman emperors. Could that have something to do with this fact that there is this temptation then to go and worship the emperor because they have these temples there in these cities? Number three, we have to see that in the context, this is not something that was accidentally received. I think that's something that is just important for our society today. A lot of times people talk about 666 as something like something that happens to you, or something that you receive, or something that it's not just something that is placed on you by accident, but the government comes along and slaps you with a barcode or slaps you on the forehead with the number 666. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is not something that is accidentally received, but rather it is something you participate in, the worship of this idol, the worship of this beast, and you claim your allegiance, you place your allegiance in this beast. And so Christians are going to be persecuted because they would not worship the government. They would not worship this beast. And so the result is they are going to be persecuted, and you can see then how this would be a huge temptation for Christians in the first century. If they're going to be persecuted because they don't go and worship this beast, everybody else is going to worship, but we can't because we know that there is one God, and he is the only one that receives our worship. And so this would be a huge temptation. What does John say? What does the Holy Spirit say through John? Don't do it. You need to understand. Calculate the number of this beast. The number is 666. Okay, well, what does that mean? It's very popular to take this number and create some type of gematria is the formal word for this. But a gematria is simply a code. Find a code in the word itself, or in the number, and then try to calculate what this word is by calculating the number. You get my drift? So for example, there's a lot of people that just sit down and just play with this number all day long. I mean, not literally all day long, but all the time, thinking about, okay, oh, look. Well, here is a Caesar that had, if you take this name and you abbreviate it in just this certain way, and you calculate the numbers in just this certain way, that it comes out to be 666. But not only the Caesars, but today it's popular also to go on and say, well, look at the presidents of the United States. And look how we can calculate even their names and even their personalities. There's certain cities that if you take a certain system and calculate it, New York is one of the ones that came up as, oh, it's the mark of the beast. Different computers, coronavirus. In fact, there's a calculator online, gmatrix.org, if you want to go in and plug in your own number. If you want to plug in 666, you can figure out and what combinations can I put in here that would actually if I type in David Andrew Rafe into this, it comes out to be 666. Can you get where I'm going with this? You can use your imagination to make anything work.
This type of gematria is really becomes more like cloud watching, where you look at the clouds and you figure out, okay, well, I can make anything out to be. Whatever is in my imagination, that's kind of what it looks like now. And the same thing is true with this particular number. So often, what people do is they'll say, well, now who is the enemy of the United States? Oh, it's Russia. So Russia is going to be the beast now. It was Bin Laden. Bin Laden must be the beast for a while. Or maybe it's Saddam Hussein way back when. And so everybody takes whoever is our enemy, and we say, oh, that must be what the mark of the beast is. A couple things about this. Number one, so often when people do this with items today, with names of different presidents or names of different sicknesses or whatever the case may be, we have to wonder, if this is something that, in order to understand 666, should we believe that you have to also understand English? That you also have to understand American politics? They have to understand modern day history? These are messages not to get Christians in the first century ready for politics of the 2000s. But these are messages to get Christians ready for persecution in the first and second century. Does that make sense? And so what we're looking at is, while it's popular to see some sort of code behind this 666 and say, oh, wow, this is going to equal this. And you know what? There may be something. I'm not convinced, however, now that 2,000 years have passed by, it may be that someone living during the time of Jesus or during the time of John would have been able to say, oh yeah, this is exactly what it is. All of this comes to, we have this other revelation, and all of this comes to we understand this. However, it might be better to look at all of this as just what the verse says, calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man. His number is 666. Taking this and understanding that, why is it so important, 666? Well, it's very different from the number 7. 7 is a number that we've seen is something that is holy. It's very something that is associated with God. But the number 6, that's one less than 7. Could it be that here we have something that is, well, this is a number that is a number for man. And that the whole point here is not so much that you need to start looking at different codes and different names, but rather the whole point is make sure that when you see this invitation by this second beast to go and worship the first beast, just know this is something of man. No matter how tempting it looks, no matter how much this second beast talks like a lamb or looks like a lamb, no, he is the dragon. No matter how much this first beast looks like he's gone through some type of resurrection, no. You need to understand, this is the number of a man. And so the bigger point, and that's what I hope that we can see in this chapter, the bigger point is that John is warning the Christians that they need to see through all of this business. Don't be deceived like the rest of the world. Focus on the bigger picture and understand God is the one who saves. And these beasts are offering to you, you need to reject them. But this puts the Christians in a difficult position, doesn't it? It puts them in a difficult position because what is this beast doing? It said that this beast was waging war against the saints, and in verse 7, overcoming them. In these verses as well, if someone does not sacrifice to the image of the beast, what does the second beast do? He goes and puts them to death. And there's other Christians who are not receiving the mark on their right hand or on their forehead. What happens to them? They're not able to buy. They're not able to sell. This puts them in a very difficult position. And I would imagine that many, many of the Christians then are going to be paying for this with their lives. So this is not just an easy, oh yeah,
Sure, I'm not going to do that. This is a life and death choice that you're making, serving the Lord. But then we get to chapter 14, and here's the contrast. In chapter 14, verse 1, he says, "And then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads." Do you see the contrast here? Earlier we had had the mark of the beast, and the name, his name placed then on the individuals who are sacrificing to this beast. But now in verse 1, we have this contrast, the 144,000. We saw them back in chapter 7, right? In chapter 7, we talked about this as representing the people of God who are going to have to go through persecution. But the promise in chapter 7 is God puts his name upon them. He identifies them. They are mine, and they will not. That God would protect them. Protect them how, though? In these chapters, it looks like the saints are dying. And indeed, in verse 4, in chapter 1, in chapter 14, it looks like they are dying physically. But how are they now? Even though they are overcome by the beast, even though that they are dying by the second beast, what is happening to them now? The 144,000, having his name and the name of the Father written on their foreheads, they are identified by God. "And I heard the voice from heaven like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of the harpist playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth." These were the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Chapter 12 ends with this idea that the dragon is enraged and he makes war against the saints. Chapter 13 tells us about that war and about the persecutions that come on Christians. And this is a devastating blow to Christians. What is going to happen? But even though chapter 13 tells us about the death of many Christians, how are these Christians now in chapter 14? What a beautiful contrast. You might worry about them, but don't. Because these Christians, where are they? The 144,000? They're standing victorious with the Lamb. They're standing with his name on their forehead and the name of the Father on their forehead. They identify with the Lamb continually. And they have a special place in heaven. Because while all the angels are amazing, and the elders are amazing, and the four living creatures are amazing, they have a story to tell that nobody else can tell. That's an amazing thought. Christians arriving there in heaven can tell their story and sing a song of redemption that nobody else can sing. They sing the song of the redeemed. They have been purchased by the Lamb. And they have been delivered in a way that that the angels can only dream about, only witness from afar. But we get to participate in this. They stand with the Creator, having been purchased by the blood of the Lamb, and they are ones who have kept themselves pure. In verse 4, it talks about ones who have not defiled themselves with women. It talks about them who talks of those who have not lied, or that there no lie is found in their mouth. They are blameless. They are people who are holy, set apart for the Lord. I think we have to say, though, that these are people who have not always been holy.
we have to understand that these are individuals who were part of the world, but now what happened to them? They have been purchased by the blood of the Lamb. And they have been made holy. And now that they are holy, they have made a decision in their repentance to do what? To follow the Lamb wherever he goes. I love that phrase. What an amazing idea. That here is the Lamb who is giving instructions to his people. And if we are Christians, we are a people that follow that Lamb. It's the Lamb that is supposed to be shepherded, right? But here is the Lamb that is the shepherd, is the good shepherd for all of his people. Are we people? Are we Christians? Are we people who are willing to follow the Lamb wherever he goes? All of this is then encouragement to Christians in the first and second century who are going to be very soon going through all of this persecution and giving them an idea. Stay true to the Lamb. You just follow him. Be faithful unto death if you have to. And this is what's going to happen to you. What an encouraging message then for Christians in the first and second century about what they could do to survive and persevere through all of this. But I hope that as we read through all of this, then we are not left without application as well. This is the type of faithfulness that God wants of his people in the first century. It's also the type of faithfulness that he wants for people today, for his people today. We don't have the same situation that they had in the first century, where the government is asking us to worship it in a very overt way. But aren't there a lot of ways in the world, even today, where we are called and the world is trying to deceive us, to ally ourselves with this world? We need to be strong as Christians to persevere and to know that with the Lamb, there is victory. We need to have a strong determination to understand, number one, that we have been purchased by his blood. We have been sanctified by him. We are Christians. But then also, we need to have the determination that wherever the Lamb goes, whatever he asks me to do, that's what I'm going to do. And I hope that this application and this encouragement will be for us today. Let this phrase be our motivating phrase for the rest of this week. That these are those who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. Let that be the phrase that pushes you the rest of this week. I want to be one of those who follows the Lamb wherever he goes. I hope that can be our in our memory as we go throughout this week. Thank you so much.